Welcome to Alligator Preserves, everyone. I am your host, Laurel McCarg, and I have an extra special guest with me today. He happens to be a classmate of mine from West Point class of 1983. He's written a book that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about some other fun things, too. I want to introduce you to Frank DeMuth.
Welcome to Alligator Preserves, a weekly podcast about revealing yourself through storytelling, story reading, and story writing, but probably not story arithmetic, because that's not a thing. You just might surprise yourself with the secrets you'll uncover.
Frank, welcome to Alligator Preserves.
Hi, Laurel. Thanks for asking me in. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad that you're here, too. It's only been, what, 40 years since maybe we've seen each other?
Yeah, well, you know, once every 40 years, you know, I'll be 120 next time, maybe.
Maybe. Oh, are we going to the next? When's our next reunion? I missed the 40th.
Do 45th. I have to wait?
45th. Maybe I'll make it to the 45th. You know, it's a flight for me from Salida, Colorado. So, Frank,
yes.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Frank DeMuth. Your bio is on your website and on Amazon about all the things you've done in your past. Who are you today?
Well, today I'm a happily retired veteran and husband to the best wife in the world.
Aww.
And now I'm an award-winning author.
You are. And the book we're going to be talking about today that you've won the Best Military Book in 2023 from the International Impact Book Awards. Your
yes.
book is called Of Vital Interest. Absolutely fabulous book. So, okay, award-winning author, husband to a wonderful wife. What else? Who else are you?
Well, I'm a person who grew up on the south side of Chicago. And my choices were to either join the military or go to the steel mill with my dad. And I decided on the military.
All right. Did
so
you
I
ever?
I enlisted before we even started.
Okay.
I went as an enlisted person to the prep school and then on to West Point. So I had a couple of years. And that's why my brick in front of the AOG building says Gramps.
Association of Graduates, for those of you listening today. Gramps, so were you one of the oldest in our class? Because I thought I was.
There's a couple other ones who were a little older than me, but I'm right up there.
All righty.
I acted older, though. I was just not a fast runner and just kind of went at my own pace and got done. But
you've always been a Gramps. Yeah, I went to Smith for a year and a half before I decided to change my life completely and go to West Point. But that's a different story. All right. So there are a couple things in your bio that I have to ask you about.
Sure.
What is the deliberate discomfort challenge? Because as if you didn't have enough deliberate discomfort going through West Point and then being in the military for 28 years, what is that challenge?
Well, that's a challenge run by a company called Mission 60. And they are a bunch of retired special forces personnel. And it's led by a military academy grad, Jason Van Camp. And what they do is they developed a 60-day challenge. And it challenges everything from physical, mental, spiritual. You do meditation every day. And you do six domains every day. And you have to complete every one of them or you get recycled back to the beginning. And there's no Sundays, there's no breaks, there's 60 days straight of doing these challenges. And they get progressively harder. So the last week we were doing ruck marches with 60-pound packs for over an hour.
When did you do this?
I did this, it started in January of 23.
2023?
I was in my mid-60s when I did it. and it came from Matt Crumlin.
No way.
I was in a really depressed state of mind at that time. I had retired and I had done all the honey-do list stuff, and I didn't know what else to do. So I was just sitting and vegetating and not really getting anything accomplished. And so Max sent, he posted something on LinkedIn, and all it said was deliberate discomfort challenge. So I figured, you know, it's one of my classmates, I'll sign up. So I signed up without even reading it. And then the next day was the day before it started. And I said, well, maybe I should read this beforehand so I know what I'm, and I read it and I about fell out of my chair. But, you know, I signed up. It's like giving my word and I'm not going to quit. So I pushed my way through it, and it was the best thing that happened to me.
Oh my gosh. I have to look into that a little bit more. Well, obviously something in your blood craves challenge, and I can relate to that. So tell me what the Endless Six is, because you're a member of that. That sounds like a really secret organization, and maybe you can't tell me. Maybe you'll have to kill me after you answer the
email. Well, no, you know, you do it, and then they call themselves the tribe. So you're part of the tribe. And when you're going through it, you lean on the other people in the challenge to get through the challenge. And it's really great. It's probably one of the closest things to the feeling of being in a unit that I've experienced since I retired.
Wow. Cooperate and graduate, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's kudos to you for doing that, for doing it blindly, which, you know, I think sometimes we do those things and they change our lives and enrich us in ways that we would never imagine.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I went on your Facebook page because, you know, before I do interviews, I like to find out some things about people. And there was a really cool post from Sergeant Major Bill Armstrong. And he said that since he met you, there were so many firsts that you presented him with. He said, you were the first saxophone player I ever enlisted into the Army.
Yep.
The first recruit I ever got into West Point. The first person who owned a Mustang II and later rebounded and became a real car aficionado with the truck and the Jeep. And now, as far as I know, the first published author. So you clearly had an impact on Sergeant Major Bill Armstrong. How did he influence you?
Well, it was my recruiter. So the story goes, I had a friend of mine who he had already enlisted, and he was going into the 82nd, I think. And he needed another person to join to get another stripe. So he went through all of his other friends, and then they finally came to me. Because I don't think anybody really thought I was going to join. So I told him,
Why didn't they think you would join? What was it about you?
Yeah. I was a musician. I played professional music before I joined the Army. And so everybody was like, well, he's not going to join. He's a musician. So the recruiter, I told him, I said, okay, I'll do it. And I was 17.
Wow.
So I knew my parents had to sign the paperwork. So he shows up at the house and he laid the paperwork out on the table. And I didn't think my parents were going to sign it. I really didn't.
And you probably didn't read it either, kind of like the deliberate discovery.
They were
challenge.
Like they were fighting over it to see who would sign it first.
Oh.
And then after he left, I asked him, I said, well, just, my dad's like, well, it'd be the best thing you could ever do, except you should have joined the Navy. Because my dad was in the Navy during the Korean War.
Okay.
And before Sergeant Armstrong left, he talked me out on the stoop of the house, and he had tattoos on his hand. He had L-O-V-E on one hand, on the knuckles, and on the other one, he had H-A-T-E. And he lifts his hands up, and he says, I'm going to be here at 4 a.m. on the 21st of November to take you to the center to bring you down to join the Army. He says, you're either going to meet love or hate when I get here. If you're not standing out on the stoop, I'm going to come in and get you and drag you to the car.
Awesome. And did he have to drag you to the car?
Oh, heck no. I was out there waiting. I was like, nope, he's an Army guy. I'm not going to mess with him.
That is That is amazing. I really enjoyed reading that about him. So, all right, here's the real question. Here's the question of vital interest.
Okay.
Where did you learn how to write? Because I know it wasn't plebe English at West Point.
Well, I credit it to all the things I wrote in between the academy and retiring. I mean, I had the experience of writing regulations, policies, memoranda.
All right, boring. Boring. And your book is not boring. How did you learn how to write a book that was not boring?
I always wanted to write something that wasn't like that.
Okay.
So, you know, I this is the third book I actually wrote. This is the first one that was published.
Okay.
So the other ones were factual books. And I found out that I don't enjoy writing those as much. Because I like to let my mind work and to focus on something. And I actually, the funny part is when I wrote this, I saw the action in my mind as I was writing it. So all it was putting words on paper from what I was seeing in my mind. And I work books like I did papers. So I have outlines and I follow them pretty, you know, loosely, but I followed the general themes and everything. And I had character sketches. So that's how I was able to write the book in 90 days.
90 days.
90 days from start to finish.
That's fabulous. All right. Here's another question. And you have to be honest. Okay.
Sure.
A cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. A vital interest. Who are you in this novel?
Well, I'm actually not in this one, but it's a trilogy. No, honestly, it's a trilogy. This is built off a lot of people that I knew, a conglomeration of individuals. But the third book of this series will take place in the United States, and I personally will be in that one by name.
Well, are you going to call it a novel, or is it going to be an autobiography?
It's still a novel. It's still the third book in what I'm calling the Carson Trilogy.
Okay.
But when you go through this, the program that Sergeant Abdullah is in was a program I designed.
All right.
In the Pentagon, the 09 Lima Interpreter Translator Program. I was on a team that designed that for the Army, and we actually recruited over 1,500 people with Arabic or Dari or Pashto language skills that were green card holders to support the military. And I was the only military person on that team. The rest were civilians.
All right. I learned a lot about the interpreter program from this. It was really fascinating.
It was an amazing part of my career.
How did you get into that? I mean, what drew you to that field?
Well, I was pulled into that, not I didn't voluntarily just do it. I worked in the G1, the personnel office at the Pentagon for the Army.
Okay.
And I was an accessions analyst responsible for the Army Reserve and National Guard recruiting numbers. And the Secretary of Defense tasked the military to come up with programs to recruit individuals like this. And the initial thought was they would be in the inactive ready reserve and then mobilize when they were needed to go overseas. Mm-hmm. So the general officer that was in charge of the section I was in, he brought a packet over and put it on my desk. And I looked at it and I requested to talk to him. And I went in and he explained to me what it was, you know, and that it was started, but it really hadn't got any traction. And he said, I want you to take it, and I want you to take it as far as you can. So for me, that was the green light. And we took it from the original perception of being in the inactive ready reserve to making it a MOS, military occupational units, two units in the active army, and one in the guard and one in the army reserve when we finished.
What language did you take at West Point?
I took Russian.
All right. And do you speak many languages right now?
Russian, Polish, French, and sometimes English.
Sometimes English. All right. Well, a vital interest. when I started reading about Al-Khafaji, I think I pronounced that correctly, I was thinking, is Frank setting up a red herring here? Is Al-Khafaji really going to be a good guy? Is he going to save the day? Very quickly, you find out, no, he's not. And he is such a credible character. He's young. He's full of this suppressed bravado. I mean, you really captured his character really well. And then we have Abdullah, who is almost too good to be true as a soldier and as a character. Did you know an Abdullah?
I did.
Tell me about him.
There was a soldier who we had supporting the special forces. And we got a call one day saying that we need to make sure in our training that we teach them that they can't always be the first one that goes through the door.
Because
they were an asset and they needed them for those language and cultural awareness skills that they brought with them.
And the first one through the door sometimes
get targeted. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the one that you knew that you based this character on?
It was a compilation of several individuals, but that stuck out in my head from the time I was told that to the time I wrote the book, and it was years in between. And I always wanted to write something to provide support and acknowledgement of what these individuals did. It's really an immigrant story of success.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely felt that. And again, you developed each of your characters beautifully. You know, Aisha, probably the weakest character in the whole book. We're not going to say until when, but right. Something happens and it's perfect. It's wonderful what you did. And
I thought about that for a long time. I wanted to do something for her. And that was what I came up with.
Really, really impactful. Your dialogue is awesome. There are lots of inappropriate words. just real. I mean, I was listening to your dialogue as I was reading it, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, yeah, this is talk around the motor pool. You know, I was in the transportation corps, so I spent a lot of time in motor pools. And there's definitely some colorful language, we'll say. And you're so detail oriented in this that I really felt like I was standing there in the chow line with the soldiers going through, because you like I said, you capture it all. You take us through some basically mundane things that happen in the Army, but you make it real. So you did a fabulous job. So I commend
you.
Well,
the mundane things in the Army is what makes our Army the best in the world, because we practice the mundane so much that it becomes second nature when we get on the battlefield.
All right. I never thought of it that way. Well, let's talk about leadership lessons. So in here, and I really, really enjoyed the scene where the lieutenant is expecting the respect that he deserves in the field, right? And he's schooled on why you don't salute in the field. I really enjoyed the way you did that. I was hoping that the lieutenant wasn't going to be a total jerk, and he wasn't, and he listened and he learned, which is great. What kind of leadership lessons really stuck with you while you were in?
Well, the biggest thing for me was how professional our non-commissioned officer corps is. And the fact that if you're going to be a good officer, you need to lean on that experience and that professionalism that you see in the non-commissioned officers. I think a lot of times the officer, young officers that don't do well are the ones that just think they're it, which this lieutenant did not do, thank God.
So thinking back to our time at West Point.
Yep.
Did they do leadership right there back when we were there? And again, I know things have changed, but.
I would say no. And let me explain.
Yeah.
We were in the period where I think they were focusing on our field officer time. We got very little lower level leadership instruction. We had staff training. We had a lot of other things that would come into play later in our career. But when I got to my first unit, what I noticed was that the officers that came from ROTC seemed to be doing a better job with the small unit leadership. And I wondered why. And then I started talking to them. And when they went through ROTC, their focus was on small unit leadership. What they were going to be doing as a platoon leader and a company commander or a company executive officer. And when you think back on what we did, we really didn't have that focus. Or at least I didn't. I didn't think so.
Oh, and again, the idea of the hazing and the yelling and the demeaning and the, we got to break it down so we can build you up. I mean, you wouldn't do that to a soldier as an officer.
No,
you get taken out in the field.
And when I was there, I already had three awards from my enlisted time. Yeah. And I remember one day in the dining hall, a yearling, a sophomore, looking at me and telling me I'll never be a good soldier. And I just kind of bowed my head and looked down at my medals and raised my head back up. So I've already been there.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings, I guess, because I know part of it is, well, you know, can you take the heat? Can you maybe play the game? Can we break you easily? And all that, but still, I think there are probably better ways of doing that, and I hope they've learned that now.
Yeah, I think they're making some adjustments.
Yeah. You really captured the pre-deployment intensity, the stress, the excitement, the fear, the unknown, the fact that there's not enough time. How many pre-deployment exercises have you been involved in your 28 years of military service? Because I was sensing everything that you were describing.
Yeah, there. I mean, I've been to quite a few places, but I've never had pre-deployment training for actual combat. Okay. The one time when I thought I would was in Germany, and we had a lot of pre-deployment training, but we never were ordered to go to the war. But it's always like that. I mean, even the people I talk to that have deployed, you never know if you're doing another exercise or you're going. So you got to have everything together and treat every time you do it, you got to treat it like it's actual.
Yeah. It felt real. It felt actual. Not enough time. Never enough time.
No.
Right. And with the interpreter program, you know, training up the four people who are being trained up in your story, not enough time.
Yeah.
How much time is needed, do you think?
Well, that's a lot of people aren't familiar with the difference between a linguist and interpreter.
Okay.
A linguist is just somebody who knows a language. And you know, there's really no training required to be a linguist other than if you don't know the language to start with. But somebody who has a green card still has a fundamental knowledge of the language that they spoke previously. Even when you take the green card holders, we had their AIT, Advanced Individual Training, was a course set up by the Defense Language Institute Foreign Language Center. And they had people at Fort Jackson that taught them interpretation. Mm-hmm. And even when they finished, they were not, they were beginner or mid-level interpreters. Simultaneous interpretation is something that takes years and years and years to accomplish.
And that's being able to
simultaneously tell someone in English what's being said in the foreign language. Mm-hmm. And then in my book, there's two different groups now. There's the interpreter translators, and then there's the military accessions vital national interests, which was the four other characters. Those four characters hadn't had any experience with interpretation training. That's why that was being taught to them before deployment.
And the fact that interpreting is more than just translating.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's pretty evident as you get through getting into the book.
Yes, yes. It's understanding things that aren't said. It's understanding how things are said, body language, the environment, yep. All of that. That was fascinating to me. I had no idea. It was, yeah, really great. All right. So I have to laugh because you use the expression in there. One of your characters uses the expression, not my circus, not my monkeys.
Yep. Old Polish saying.
My husband, Mike, uses this expression all the time as a way of, I think, you know, protecting himself from unnecessary things. Right.
Right.
So when did you first hear this? Because again, you know, first time I heard it was when Mike said it, not my circus, not my monkeys. And he has other people saying it now too, because it's a great saying. How do you use it?
Well, I grew up in Chicago in a Polish family.
Okay.
So we heard it quite often and I grew up with it. So it's kind of nice to find some place to put it in a book.
Perfect. And again, you know, it has to do with our level of accountability and what we can influence, right? Our sphere of influence.
Yeah, it's kind of like none of my business. I'm not in it.
Right. Yeah, not my circus, not my monkeys. And then, of course, hope is not a method. And that's another thing that Mike says all the time, too, because a lot of people hope. They hope for things. And it's not a method, right? I mean, you can't hope that you're going to write a book and a book happens. You have to actually do something.
That was another old Army saying that I heard a lot of times.
Yeah. Planning, planning, planning. So you were a planner for a vital interest. You planned this. So you're not a pantser, but while you were writing this, and a pantser is someone who writes by the seat of their pants, which I do a lot of, and it's, I think, way more fun than planning. I never liked outlining, but you planned a lot of this. Did you have surprises while you were writing it? Did any of your characters or situations surprise you, kind of come out of nowhere?
I really didn't. I didn't have ahead of time. I didn't plan out these instructors' retirement. I wrote that as I got there. We have a situation in the book where a senior soldier makes a decision that he's going to retire and not accompany the unit overseas. But nobody knows about it but the very senior person in his team. And so nobody asks questions why he's not going, because everybody trusts each other and they just know it has to be a good reason.
Mm-hmm. No, again, you did that really well. So hope may not be a method, but what do you hope for our nation right now? Knowing what
my
you know.
My biggest hope is that we stop this party bickering between the two major parties in our political system. It just got to the point where it's very scary. The fact that they can't agree on much of anything. And they need to get back to what they're there for. And we can't have these 6-8 month continuing resolutions anymore. We have to have a budget when the Constitution says we're supposed to have a budget, not 6 months later.
Leadership. We need leadership.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And quit petty bickering between each other.
Well, after reading A Vital Interest, and sometimes people say you can learn a lot about an author from reading their work, which makes me a little bit nervous sometimes.
I love your book.
But after reading this book, I believe your soldiers probably loved and respected you a lot. Did you feel that?
I certainly hope so. The unit that I commanded in Germany, the Patriot Battery, we still have reunions every couple of years.
That says a lot. Frank, do you still know the definition of leather?
Geez.
If I started it with you, sir,
probably
the fresh skin of an animal cleaned and divested of all extraneous matter be immersed in a, say it with me, dilute solution of tannic acid. A chemical combination ensues. The gelatinous tissue of the skin is converted into a non-putrescible substance impervious to and insoluble in water. This, sir, is leather. Why do I still know that, Frank? Why do I still know that?
I don't know. I was more thinking about milk, but.
Did you say milk? How's the cow?
Yeah, the something from the female of the bovine
how's
series
the cow?
Is highly
sir,
prolific to the.
Yeah,
how's a cow? Yeah,
she walks, she talks, she's full of chalk. The lacteal fluid extracted from the female of the
bovine
species
series is
highly prolific
to
the
entropy.
Oh my God.
I remember that one.
The things that we had to memorize.
Senseless and knowledge.
Senseless, and yet, you know, when I'm 95 and I can still recite the definition of leather, I think that'll make me feel a little better.
Yeah, I still have trouble remembering what I had to eat 2 days ago.
Oh, we won't get into that. Anyway, what is next for you, Frank DeMuth, author of award-winning A Vital Interest, which is a fascinating book and a timely book, I would say. And I think everybody ought to read it because it's really so well done. What's next? Are you plugging something? Do you have something going on?
Well, I do. As far as the book goes, there's going to be at least two more in the series that I'm calling the Carson Trilogy.
Okay.
When I finish those two books, I'm planning on writing one additional book for each of the three remaining linguist Mabini soldiers.
Okay.
To let everybody know what happens to them. I don't want to leave anybody out. And then starting the 29th of April and going through the 14th of June, which is Flag Day.
Okay.
So between that time period, every book that sells, whether it's hardcover, paperback, or Kindle book, I'm going to donate $1 per copy to Warrior Rising, which is a veteran-run group for veterans to help them find their dream of running a business.
That's fabulous. That is wonderful. Excellent. Do you have any shout-outs? Anyone you want to acknowledge?
Well, I already shouted out to my wife because she's my backbone and my strength. I'd like to shout out to our classmate, Mike Crumlin. Yes, who really gave me the inspiration to do the things I needed to do to write this book.
Really?
And I'll always be grateful for his support and putting me in the right frame of mind.
I recently had dinner with him. He came out to Breckenridge and I drove out there and had an amazing dinner with a bunch of classmates I hadn't seen in 40 years. And it was really fun. We have a lot of talented people in our class.
Oh my God. I have to pinch myself sometimes just to make sure it's real. I just being a part of the class is the greatest thing that I've done besides the birth of my two daughters.
I would have to agree. It was both the worst times and the best times of my life.
Yeah, but the bonds last forever.
I know. The military is a family. However dysfunctional it may be at times, it's a family that you have the rest of your life. And, like I said, I meet you after 40 years and, we have a bond and it's pretty cool. I think it's pretty awesome. Frank DeMuth, thank you so much. Listeners out there, I will have show notes with links and photos, some adorable photos of Frank and maybe of me too, when we were youngsters at West Point, on my website at leadvillelaurel.com. And we will look forward to your next books. Frank, stay active. Don't do anything too crazy anymore. Well, I shouldn't say that because, why not? Why not do crazy things? Do you agree?
Yeah, maybe I'll jump off a plane again.
I don't know that I'll do that again. I think five times was enough. Landing on my head, breaking the straps inside my helmet on one of my jumps. Ouch. Yeah, it was the night jump. I remember that we had for the night jump, we had to find a buddy and quietly go to the light and, get the parachute up and, get off the field. And I remember hitting the ground hard. And then I remember standing up and yelling, "Buddy!" And I don't know who it was. If you remember out there, someone who might be listening, if you remember who you were, who helped me off the field and to the light before I got my head examined. No permanent damage. That was an interesting jump. So no, I think I'll keep my feet on the ground. Anyway, Frank DeMuth, thank you for spending this time with us. And I love your book and keep writing. And we'll maybe see you at the next reunion.
I'll be there.
Take care. Bye.
Alligator Preserves is hosted and produced by Laurel McCard, with technical support provided by her husband, Mike McCard. Follow her on her website at leadvillelaurel.com, where she writes about life, real and imagined. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy her books. Find her work at amazon.com.